Are you an artist, band, or record label? We want you to send us your music so we can put it on the radio. Not only this station, but stations across Canada. Check out earshot-distro.ca and share your music with more than 100 radio stations and programmers across the country. Earshot Distro is made by and for the campus community radio sector to help emerging musicians. Uploads cost $7 per song or $50 per album. Learn more at earshot-distro.ca.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Quay.
Why eat beef snack seal?
Tanche.
Tanek e. Negad dakote.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Pogotawatimuk. Greetings. I'm wishing you well. And thank you, Marcy, to Elder Susan Sinclair for her sharing of that word. Pitigwe, s'il vous plaît. Welcome to Words and Culture, the Michif episodes. Sheila Rogers, Dishini Kashun. My name is Sheila Rogers, and it's an honor to be your host and to be with you as we together learn about the Michif language and Métis culture. Winnipeg, Niwikin. I live in Winnipeg, Treaty 1 territory, the homeland of the Red River Métis. I've been on a voyage of reconnection with my Métis family here for many years, but I actually moved here 2 years ago, and this journey continues at the ripe old age of, okay, here it comes, I'm 69. Today's episode is about reconnection, and it takes our title, Words and Culture, quite literally. Our guest is Tracy Charette Fair. She's a Métis scholar and textile and clay artist. In February of 2024, Tracy initiated a project called Honoring Our Métis Mothers, which is also Honoring Our Métis Matriarchs, the idea being to stitch, bead, and quill the names of our grandmothers, mothers, aunties, daughters, sisters, cousins, friends onto squares. So that's the word part, the names. The culture part is the Michif needlework that would have been practiced by our grandmothers, by our Métis matriarchs, beading, embroidery, and quill work. The pieces with the women's names were created over tea and coffee, and perhaps the odd timbit, to be honest, and they commemorate the lives of Métis women. The process of making these squares brought Michif people together from all over North America, around tables, and virtually by Zoom. Stories were shared, the tea was spilled, friendships were born, and cousins met long-lost cousins. The completed work is comprised of almost 300 squares of names sewn onto panels, which are then sewn onto a 63-foot bolt of red broadcloth, symbolizing the Red River. It was exhibited at the Winnipeg Art Gallery this past February, but hopefully it will get out into the world and travel. What you're about to hear is a wonderful story about building connection and community, one stitch at a time. Here is the Michif artist, Tracy Fair.
My name is Tracy Charette Fair. I live in Winnipeg, and my roots are here. I'm originally, my family is St. Norbert, and then St. Malo's, La Rochelle, Manitoba. It's in southern Manitoba, in a small Métis community. I'm Métis on my mother's side, settler on my dad's side. And I am, an interdisciplinary artist, but I tend to work in these days in textiles, fabric, embroidery, and beads, and ceramics as well. And even though I work in those mediums, I don't really sew. So I tend to say I work with thread and things that, use thread.
What drew you to thread work?
I am not really sure. I was in my last year, I was doing my BFA. This was not that long ago, so I started later in life with my studies. But my final year, we were doing paper making, and the instructor, the professor I had, wanted us to do some embroidery onto this handmade paper. So I did this, and something just took. I don't know what it was. It almost felt like over time it was a bit of a memory. It was a physical memory. Now, I had learned how to hand stitch when I was very young. We had to learn all the different things. I'd learn how to hem my own pants and hem things. So, but there was something in it that really appealed to me, and I just kept doing it. I just started stitching. I found an embroidery teacher here in Winnipeg and did embroidery with her. But as I was doing that, I started to think about Métis embroidery because it was something that was in the back of my mind. And I thought, isn't that funny? You know, I don't know why I'm drawn to this. And then I started to do some research into Métis embroidery and really looked at the rich history, the specific designs. So that took me on a whole tour of, I went on a 6-week tour of Quebec, and I got to see a lot of that work. So it was in birch bark, it was in moose hair, it was in porcupine quill. So I just became fascinated with the whole trajectory and the history, and I wanted to know how the effects of those sisters, even several hundred years back, had on my aunts and my mother. You know, my aunts and my mother lived with a lot of shame. Just a lot of shame about being Métis. And we were a family that knew we were Métis. That wasn't always the case. I spent a lot of time with my aunts gathering their stories verbally, and they were able to tell me a lot of what it was like for them growing up, to the point where they left school really early because once they went to the big town, there was so much racism, and they were subject to that. They were ashamed for their mother to be seen because of her color and the names they were called. So there was just so much shame. And it wasn't until they left Manitoba that they felt that they could be more themselves or feel okay about themselves. So I'm not claiming responsibility, but they became very much a part of what I'm doing. And which, you know, I can talk about in a minute, but they were a lot of the inspiration. My mother died when I was very young, so she died before this research. And she died when it was just shameful, you know, to be Métis, especially here in the homeland, mm-hmm. you know, in the Red River. Mm-hmm. It became a place where you didn't want to say who you were. And if people recognized it, you tried to hide it in one way or another, or you were marginalized in some way or another. So there was all of that. So I wanted to see what the words of these, how that did it travel through this needlework. And I found that there was this trajectory. So I did a project at that time called Colonization and Thread. And then from there, I just branched off into other ideas, all of them sort of connected to our Métis history, our Métis present, you know, because it's not all historical. We are Métis now, and we are not part of history, which is something I had been taught at one time at one of the universities, is that I was considered a fact of history, but no longer existing. And that was in an early Native Studies course. And it was sat with me for a long time and caused me to go silent, you know.
Part of this sort of conscious vanishing of Indigenous people, mm-hmm. but Métis people who are often, so often, referred mm-hmm. to as the forgotten people.
Yeah. And we have been. And in some ways, look, there's a big resurgence now and people are coming back. That had been disappeared, you know, for so long. People are coming back. And sometimes we get some criticism for that. You know, it's good, but there can also be some, you know, you're going to take advantage of this or do this or, you know, so there can be sometimes a bit of a resentment. But I'm really happy to be part of that resurgence of Métis identity, seeing it in my own family. You know, I have other siblings who didn't have the memories that I had and really took them a while to go, oh, yeah, they knew, too, that they were Métis, but they kind of were of the same thinking. It's like, are we really Métis now? You know, people say we don't look Métis, so you know, like, you know.
Are
so
we Métis enough?
Are you Métis enough? And a lot of people struggle with that as part of their identity. You know, maybe I'm not enough. I'm not this, or I'm not that, or I wasn't born here, or I didn't do this, or, you know, there's so many doubts about whether we can accept that and if we can claim our, not just our heritage, but our identity now. You know, so that's kind of what is behind some of what I do in the past few years. A lot of the work that I have done is about Métis women, the matriarch, the mothers, sisters, grandmothers. So that's been my focus. And a lot of that, too, is driven by my matriarchal family. I grew up with women, you know, for the first 7 years of my life. It was all aunties and not grandmothers so much, because my grandmothers had my grandmother was already passed, but all the women and cousins and all of that. So I was kind of surrounded by that for the first few years. And I have five sisters, so.
I want to talk to you about the Honoring Our Métis mm-hmm. Mothers project.
Yeah.
I don't even know where to begin to mm-hmm. describe it, so I'm going to throw that one to you.
Okay. Well, it has been something that was in the making probably for a long time in my mind, if not physically. I usually talk about how it started, and it started with, in 2020, when I was doing my genealogy and finding out more about the grandmothers that went further back, I was able to identify a grandmother named Madeline Soto. And she became the sort of country wife of Alexander Henry II. So her daughter became Julie Henry. So that was my grandmother's grandmother. And she was born in the 1770s. I can't remember exactly what year, but 2020 made it 250 years since she was born. So I decided to create 250 handmade smoke-fired bowls to recognize those 250 years and all of the Métis women, well, certainly on my mom's side, but Métis women in general, from that time. So what I did is I made 250 bowls. It's a long process. It took me about a year. And then they were exhibited at the Winnipeg Art Gallery in a show in 2021. And the idea was that those bowls would be gifted to Métis women. But in exchange, they would give me a name of a woman that they wanted to honor. So about a year and a half after the exhibit, we had a bowl giving ceremony at St. Boniface Museum, which is right in the heart of our that's our sacred land, you know, right there. Louis Riel's grave is right there. The Nolan sisters, who were the first teachers, you know, Métis teachers, they have a monument right there. So it's a really important place. And so we did a bowl giving ceremony. There was, I don't know, about 100 people. There was elders. It was just a lovely event. And so people gave us names. So we had this big bowl of names. And I thought, I can't do this by myself. So I'd always imagined, for a long time, imagined getting groups of women together, of Métis women, and us going back to what we would have done at one time is work in groups and be together and be part of the community. Anyway, so it was 2024, Louis Riel Day, and we had a really nice gathering of women that came for that. I had brought all the supplies. I didn't know at that time exactly. I had 8 weeks planned where we would get together. And then all of a sudden, St. Boniface Museum said, you can just keep coming. So now we had the space at St. Boniface Museum, which was another perfect place to begin this, because there we had historic pieces just on the hall from us. Mm-hmm. It was like the spirit of those women was there anyway, with all of the stuff that they had in the museum just down the hall. And so gradually things started to build, and the community started mm-hmm. to build. People came regularly. After a while, people just come in, they'd take out their supplies or they'd pick up some supplies from what we had, and we'd all sit down and we'd just talk and sew.
I'm going to stop you there because I was there mm-hmm. for the first couple, mm-hmm. but I want to ask you, as you reflected on mm-hmm. that room about the women who came, mm-hmm. about the people who came, yeah. What did you think when they came out and started sharing their stories? You asked us all to introduce ourselves.
Right.
And to talk about the woman that we would, whose name we would sew or bead onto, as you say, the supplies.
Yeah.
Squares of blankets. Mm-hmm. You had embroidery floss. You had beads. You had hide. You had fur. you had everything that our matriarchs would have had at hand to work with.
Mm-hmm. And it was all there for anybody to do whatever they wanted to with it. And part of it was there was no prescribed, we weren't making quilting squares, nothing had to look the same. The idea was it was to think about a woman that you wanted to honor and then create something in their name. And as we went around that circle that day and people were talking, it was really moving. People talked about, well, sometimes it was their mother, their grandmother, maybe a sister, alive or not. It didn't, you know, it wasn't, or in spirit, it didn't mean that that person had to be deceased either. And so people went around the circle and there was tears and there was happiness and there was a feeling of connection. And most people left with finding a new cousin.
Yeah.
Which tends to happen at gatherings.
Exactly. Exactly. It was so beautiful.
And one thing that really came through, and it came through throughout and really strengthened at, towards our last bit. Well, we're not over yet, but towards we were getting closer to the unveiling, which I'll talk about. Was the sense that we were not just doing something that our mothers or grandmothers would have done. We were the descendants of those women. So we were mixing with them. And we were now the descendants of those women who would have been together. So we had, they would have been friends. And here we were, these generations later, one, two, maybe more generations sitting together and doing this work together. So they were with us, you know, throughout that. I was a bit of a fairly strict on being, I didn't ask for ID or anything like that, but we're all Red River Métis women. And the reason for that was, well, there's a lot of political stuff that I won't get into, but it was because that we would be, it wasn't open to non-Métis. And the reason being is because we needed a space where we could share freely. It's hard sometimes because you can't say things, some, you know, or you are misunderstood or people don't know the history. You know, I had someone say to me when I took them to St. Boniface Museum and we were in the Métis, she couldn't get a, understand why I could be Métis. Like, this just didn't seem to grasp that. She finally, she said, but does anybody in your family have black hair? And none of us wanted that, you know, because you do, you know, it's like, yes, there are people in my family that have black hair. Métis families come in all shapes,
like
sizes, and colors.
It's like follicle quantum. You know?
I didn't think anybody needed to, we didn't need to educate, you know, we wanted to be together, not to educate people, but what it is or what it's not. And to have our own DNA so that we were putting our energy into what we were making and that it would bring things together. So there was that intent as well.
Well, but, I will just hop in here with something that just made me bawl at the time. But listening to the women as they were talking about could have been their ancestors, their sisters, their mothers, their cousins, their aunties, their nieces, as you said, and friends.
Yeah.
At the very last minute, I was going to honor my great-grandmother, Edith, who was the first woman member of the legislature here in Manitoba and the first Métis woman.
Mm-hmm.
And at the last minute, another name came out of my mouth, and it was Donna Sutherland, who... She's the person who really sort of got me started on my journey of connection and reconnection. And I talked about Donna and her flaming red hair and how she loved corgis and and she wrote a book about Nahoué Sinclair.
Yeah.
And that's been a very important book for a lot of people. And I sat down And the woman who stood up next to me was Sally Nystrom and said, Donna Sutherland was one of my closest friends. Oh. And those stories, that's my story, but everyone there had a story like that. Mm-hmm. What really united us all was the stories, eh? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was very much, and it brought us together. It kept generating more. There was times where we would sit with a piece. Sometimes we didn't know, because going back to that gifting ceremony, we did have names that people had contributed that weren't necessarily, so we were sewing some of those names.
Right.
So somebody'd be working on a name that they didn't know.
Yeah.
And we'd all talk about that person. We'd usually find a connection to that person anyway, within the room, but it was really moving. It's like they came back to life by reflecting on who this person might be. Were they related to this? Were they from, oh, that was a neighbor, or, you know, things like that. So it was really impactful that way too. It brought these women back to life. And the reason why we were recognizing these women, and I'll get back to maybe what part of the core of this was to recognize the women in Métis history. There's a lot of talk about the men and the battles and Louis Riel, and there was nothing said much in the historical literature about the women of the Métis Nation. There's a couple things here and there. There's a book about Louis Riel's mother, and there was, you know, there's been a couple things, but there hasn't. Just the ordinary women who held things together, literally sewed things together, held the community together, kept, and really, I think, in a way, we are matriarchal. And that line coming through those women. So, and that those women, many of them lived with a lot of shame and or were just disappeared. And sometimes they disappeared into another culture. You know, in my family, that didn't happen until my mom's generation. They started marrying out of the Métis community. And that came with, because people were moving to the city, or there was, you know, they made other connections, or they didn't want to marry within their community. But before that, you married into, not just into your community. Sometimes you married your cousins. Not your first cousin, but
yeah.
So. So we were wanting to honor these women who were kind of unsung, you know, and as we did this, it was like they came to life. And in the piece that was unveiled, there was so much energy in that. And the people that came to see it, there was a lot of tears. There was a lot of pointing and recognition and then tears. And it was amazing because they were experiencing what we had gone through for this past year of coming together. There was some women that did, women who'd been murdered or missing, you know, that were family members of theirs. A lot of us, like I said, did mothers, grandmothers, sisters. I included all of my sisters, whether they were part of this or not. But when they came to the unveiling, they were so moved and honored to have been thought about. And they're still here. It had that power to be in this collective, and this collective strength that we created.
I'm going to try to create a picture of what the final being looked like. Mm-hmm. Because we had the squares, which were not big, but maybe, I don't know, 10 by 12 on 10 average.
10 by 12,
or something.
5 by 6.
Yeah.
10 by 12 would have been one of the larger ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then they were sewn onto black cotton panels. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there were maybe 4 or 5, could have been 2, but just beautifully, what was cool about that was they weren't necessarily all one family.
No.
You had the French Métis talking to the Scotch Métis, the Scottish Métis, and they were all in dialogue with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Then they were placed on the biggest bolt of red broadcloth that I've ever seen. How long was it in the end?
It was 63 feet long, not including the buffalo hide that we had, and where we had some that hadn't been connected yet. So the idea being is it's unfinished.
Yeah.
You know, there's still more to come.
It goes on.
So it would be closer to, I don't know, 65, 66 feet or something like that, and 5.5 feet wide.
Yeah.
So it was monumental.
Yeah.
And the way that we constructed it, I'm really this got this thing about it could not just be a blanket, because right, oftentimes we think about textile work and women, and it's got to be a patchwork quilt. And there was a part of me that no, that's although it's hard to avoid having elements of that, which is good too. So it ended up being this long river. So we put some, we set it up so that there was some waving underneath, and the sash. So the red broadcloth that it was framed in was the sash element. So it really hit a couple of key elements of our Métis, you know, symbol, like Métis symbolism. So the red, but the red is also spirit. It's red can be the color of many of our sashes. And then the river is so much a part of where we live. Now, inside of that, all the pieces were unique and different. You know, some were embroidered, some were, and beautifully, like some of them were really high levels of skill. Mm-hmm. And then some of them were just the most simple, very simple.
I'm holding up my hand here.
More simple than that. And yours wasn't that simple. You were one of the first ones that used some leather.
That's right.
You know, and you had other designs, but some of them might just be a name. But when you put them all together, the way they mixed, and the idea was not to segregate them into families, mm-hmm. because the idea was hopefully that people would kind of reconnect. So there was these synchronicities that happened. They happen naturally, where people that hadn't been connected for so long ended up on the same panel or side by side, you know, on different panels. So it was really quite amazing how, so it did create a dialogue, and it did bring us all back together, you know, connected back mm-hmm. together like that.
Kichi Marcy, thank you so much to Tracy Charette Fair and her great gift of bringing people together to create a powerful collaborative work of art and commemoration. I bet when the lights are off, all those women honored on the blanket squares, they're all talking to each other. For now, the lovely long piece is called Honoring Our Métis Matriarchs, but there's talk of doing a ceremony to give her a name in Michif. And that would be lovely. Next time on Words and Culture, the Métis artist, activist, and ardent land-based arts and language learner, Christy Belcourt. Her paintings of plants and creatures take their style from Métis floral beadwork. We will talk about her passion for reclaiming the language of her ancestors. Merci for joining me today. Thank you. Nimiye itain ein kitotiteik. I've enjoyed talking with you. Kawapitin mina. See you again.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Hausin Dan King Sam.
Numaltis.
Ninuis ahaha mi ku kwa kwal.
Kachu nautano.
Wapamatin mi.
This is Bird Note. Birds in the subtropics of the Andes Mountains have to be creative to get their share of food from the forest. To outsip their competition, sword-billed hummingbirds have a distinct adaptation. These birds' beaks are longer than their bodies. Found in the temperate forests from Venezuela to Bolivia, these hummingbirds have co-evolved with various flower species to create a niche food source. They rely entirely on tube-like flowers that other species could never reach. While their sword-like beaks are handy for reaching a snack undisturbed by others, a beak that long doesn't come without challenges. For one thing, it's difficult to keep clean. The solution? Sliding it back and forth against tree branches, like a knight, sharpening their blade. Then there's the problem of cleaning their feathers. Most birds can easily use their tongues, since they don't have a big, awkward beak to get in the way. Instead, sword-billed hummingbirds put their flexibility to the test and clean themselves with a good old scratch from their legs. So one big adaptation leads to new challenges. But these clever birds are up to the job. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
This episode is brought to you by